91.7 WVXU Cincinnati Edition. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. Couples who want to have children may not automatically be thinking about the difficulty of becoming pregnant, but 12% of the reproductive population is affected by infertility. We'll talk about what treatments are available for people who are facing these issues. We'll also hear about what cancer survivors can do to protect their fertility. Joining me are Bethesda Fertility Center Medical Director Dr. Glenn Hoffman and Dr. Julie Siroga with the University of Cincinnati Center for Reproductive Health. You can call us at 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Dr. Siroga, we'll start with you. How serious a problem is infertility? How many people, we say about 12%. Is that about right? Is it changing over the years?
I think we've seen an increase in infertility, but I think it's been steady between that 10 to 15% over the last couple decades. But I'd say since several decades ago, I think we've seen a slight increase. And a lot of that has to do with women that delay childbearing for professional reasons, those type of things.
I would agree. I think also that there's a lot of environmental things because I've been practicing for 25 years now, and I see younger and younger women who have what we call diminished ovarian reserve. That means their ovaries are behaving biologically much older than their chronologic age. And I don't know if it's, you know, what it is in the environment, but it's over time I've seen that young women more commonly have problems with their eggs than I did when I was 15, 20 years ago.
Does that have anything to do with how early menstruation starts? I mean, are the cycles changing in that regard?
I don't think so. I don't know the answer to your question, but I don't think it has to do when they start their periods. I think it has a lot to do with their genetics, because most women are born with the same number of eggs as everybody else. It's just that when they start puberty, that's all they have, and that egg supply might be smaller than other women, or because of environmental toxins, and cigarette smoking is probably the biggest one. For women who are smokers, it really has a very adverse effect on their ability to get pregnant and to have a healthy pregnancy. So I think, you know, as the women became of age and it was okay to start smoking, you know, they started having problems with reproduction as well.
Let's talk about how we define infertility. Now, there are times, obviously, when people get pregnant when they're not necessarily expecting to. There are other times when people are trying very hard to get pregnant and they think it's not happening quickly enough. At what point when a couple is actually trying to get pregnant do you start to say, yeah, there might be a problem here? How many months in?
Typically in a younger patient, so less than 35, we recommend kind of starting an evaluation after 12 months of attempting conception without success. In older women that are over 35, we know that that follicular ovarian pool, the number of eggs left, is declining. So we recommend the fertility workup begin at 6 months.
And what do you do? What is a fertility workup?
Well, we get a big long history and go over their gynecologic history, their reproductive history, any medical problems, any medications they're on. It's just like when you go to your family doctor, we ask all those questions. We do the same thing for the man.
When you say reproductive history, is that as if they've already had children? Like, say, maybe they're trying for a second child and having trouble? Or what's a reproductive history?
Well, that's part of it. But, you know, how often do you have cycles? How long do you bleed? Has there been any change in your cyclicity and things like that? That's all part of what we're looking for. And I think, you know, we start looking for the basics, like how's the sperm? Are the fallopian tubes open? Is the woman ovulating in a timely and a predictable fashion? And then in our practice, in that very first month, we start to focus on what is their ovarian reserve. Because again, in my experience, I've been seeing younger and younger women have problems with ovarian reserve. So we start screening them.
Even so you can go in there and see how many eggs somebody has left?
Not really. But there's various tools that we have, like anti-Mullerian hormone, preantral follicle counts. And for those of us who still believe in a day three FSH, not everybody believes in that, but I grew up with it.
I don't know what that is. Tell me what that is.
Follicle stimulating hormone is the hormone that drives the ovary every month. Okay. And as a woman approaches menopause, it gets higher and higher and higher. And then when they hit menopause, it goes up into the 60s and 70s. And originally, that was the only thing we had to evaluate ovarian reserve. So, but we start using all those tools and pooling that information to try and find out what their ovarian reserve is. And particularly, as she said, if they're over 35, that really becomes essential. Because the one thing that makes us more aggressive as infertility specialists is the woman's age.
Agreed. At UC as well, we began the same workup, and we've also started to see in younger women that previously we kind of defined as unexplained infertility with the new testing, the anti-Mullerian hormone, which is kind of a hormone level that the pre-eggs that are ready for what we call the antral follicles secrete. It kind of gives us a general idea of how many eggs are left. So we've seen a lot in younger women, so less than 35, that have diminished ovarian reserve. And we're just starting to, you know, understand more and more about this population.
Do you always start with testing the woman first, or do you test the man and the woman at the same time?
I always get sperm first.
Sperm first. Why is that?
It's easy. It's one visit. And most of the time, if it's normal, you don't have to worry about it. If it's not normal and there's problems, then you have to get into that more thoroughly, but in about 25-40% of couples will have some kind of male-associated factor, but it's just real easy.
Same thing? Test the man first?
I offer the testing at the same time to kind of move through and see, and also it's going to depend on their history. So someone that's had any, you know, toxic exposures, has had cancer before and chemotherapy in the male or the female, it might lead you to which do you test first. So it's really patient-specific.
So you're looking at all of those factors together. So say you start the testing. About how serious, and are there little problems that are easily fixed versus big problems? What's the range of what could be wrong?
You said it, little problems that are easy to fix. For example, women who don't ovulate in a timely and predictable fashion. You draw blood tests to rule out certain hormonal problems. And then we just use oral medications, Clomid or Femara or Letrozole, to get the woman to ovulate in a timely and predictable fashion. And if that's the only problem, it's pretty easy. but then it gets to be much more complex as we have tubal problems and the diminished ovarian reserve. That's a very difficult problem to solve without going to alternative things like donor egg or embryo donation and stuff.
Do you find the same problem with the what do you call it again?
Ovarian reserve.
Ovarian reserve, is that?
We do. Again, what the data has shown is that the diminished ovarian reserve really, or the anti-Mullerian hormone, will predict response during fertility treatment. But there is some new information out there that because these women have less eggs left than someone else their same age, they may have more chromosomally abnormal eggs left rather than normal ones. So they're at higher risk of miscarriage, and this might be why they're having fertility problems. And so in a lot of these women, there isn't a lot to do other than the standard treatments. And if those aren't successful, then moving on to donor egg adoption, those type of things.
Well, you talk about, you use the word miscarriage there. And is that considered also an infertility issue? I was an older mom. I had a couple of miscarriages before I had my daughter, and it was that same sort of thing. And I did some testing, but I never knew if that was an infertility issue and that I didn't have trouble getting pregnant. I just had trouble staying pregnant.
Well, at the end of the day, you're not infertile, because fertility just means can you get pregnant, but you lack fecundity, which is the ability to deliver a live born. So whether you can't get pregnant at all or you have multiple miscarriages, the latter is not infertile, but you both lack fecundity or the ability to have a child. And so the workups are different. But at the end of the day, the problem is still the same. You want a baby, and we just have to approach both of those problems a little bit differently, because there's different etiologies that go along with it. But as she said, for those women with a lot of miscarriages, particularly if they've had one child together and then they have two or three miscarriages after that, that's when you start to pick up the diminished ovarian reserve and the chromosomal abnormalities she mentioned in the products of conception.
Is there anything people can do when they're younger to try to protect those eggs?
They can. But I thought you were going to get to that at the end of the discussion.
Well, I don't mean protect. I mean, I guess I don't mean protect them in terms of, is there a way not to have the diminished egg? Is there anything that people can do? You mentioned smoking, so obviously not smoking would be a good thing. Are there other things, health-wise, other things not related to medicine that people can do to make sure that, or to try to be more fertile?
Well, I don't know, but I think, again, smoking is a major thing I think of. But I when I go to meetings and I talk to my colleagues in other parts of the country, we all do donor egg cycles. And I know how much medication it takes to get my egg donors to do what we want them to do. And my colleagues from other places give them a third or a half the amount of medication and get the same results. So there's something about
the greater Cincinnati area,
this population, that, you know, even 23, 24-year-old egg donors, it takes more medication to get them to respond the way we want so we get a healthy number of eggs, as in all places, New Jersey, you know, and,
But is there research being done about that at this point? Do you know of as to why this area has this problem?
I think in general, there's a lot of research going on right now about environmental toxins. It's one of the areas that the Reproductive Medicine Network, as well as the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, is really interested in to know, are there things that put women at risk for diminished ovarian reserve, and can we counsel against that? There's been some new data out that hand sanitizers and antibacterial soap, that might be embryotoxic or gonadotoxic, causing problems with the eggs. There's other things, what's in Teflon pans, what things that are in carpet. All of that stuff has some data that shows that there can cause injury to sperm as well as eggs. And so I don't think we have enough data as to what dosage and, you know, do we need to take that all out of our products because it's really causing a problem. It's not there yet, but I think it's kind of a focus of reproductive research right now.
What about recreational drug, alcohol use, those sorts of things? Does that cause problems?
It can. I think this is my just little gestalt on this, is I think most things in moderation are pretty much okay. Anything in excess can kill you. For example, Tylenol. We all take it for our headaches, but if you take enough Tylenol, you can rot out your liver and end up with liver cancer, and it can kill you. So I don't know about recreational drugs, because I know I shouldn't be a proponent of that, because I got college age and past college age kids, and I keep trying to keep them away from those things. But I think that, you know, particularly marijuana can affect the motility of the sperm and things like that. So there are a lot of things. And even some of the drugs that we take with prescription can have effect on those things as well. So there's a lot of things. And as she was alluding to, it's very, very hard to pinpoint a cause and effect, because things are so multifactorial that it's really difficult to say, well, we now can prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that there's cause and effect, because you can't do that right now. It's so hard.
We're talking today about infertility and treatment to help couples who want to have children. We'll continue our discussion and take your questions and your comments in just a moment. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100. Email us, talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. We're talking about infertility. My guests are Bethesda Fertility Center Medical Director Dr. Glenn Hoffman and Dr. Julie Siroga with the University of Cincinnati Center for Reproductive Health. You can join the discussion by calling us. Our number is 513-419-7100, or email us at talk@wvxu.org. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. And again, that number is 513-419-7100. So let's start with the basics. A couple has decided they'd like to have a child and they want to start trying. What's the advice you give them to have the best chance of becoming pregnant? Dr. Siroga?
I mean, I think for a woman, just looking at her menstrual cycles, are they regular? Can she predict the time of ovulation? There are several different ways to help with that. A lot of women will use over-the-counter ovulation predictor kits. You start them in the middle of your cycle, kind of around cycle day 10, and you look for a change. It essentially signals the hormone that that women have when they ovulate, and detects it in the urine. And then having frequent intercourse after that, kind of every other day, to around that time of the ovulation to increase success.
So it's you have to be pretty active.
You have to be pretty active. And, you know, if a woman's having lengthened cycles that are 40, 45 days, she's not having symptoms of ovulation, she may not be ovulating, although she thinks her periods are regular because they come every 45 days. So really that upper end of normal is about 35 days. And so if women kind of go out of that range, they're not having symptoms of ovulation, which might include breast tenderness, mood changes, bloating, they may want to talk to their gynecologist sooner just to maybe do some testing to see if they're ovulating.
I agree.
No other advice. All right. We're going to go now to a call from Sarah in Springdale. Hi, Sarah. What's your question?
Hi. I was curious about oral contraceptives, other forms of birth control, whether or not they have an effect on either preserving or any effect on egg count.
So in other words, if you've been on birth control pills, will that affect your ability to get pregnant or if you have any trouble with your eggs at that point?
Yeah, and particularly, you know, women that have been on it for, say, decades.
I kind of view how the ovary works is that each month it sends a wave of eggs towards ovulation. It's never just one egg a month. It's multiple eggs that go on a wave towards ovulation every month. And as the woman ages, the wave gets smaller and smaller. But it's just like the waves in the ocean, whether you're there or not, the waves come in all the time. And we know that the waves of eggs continue whether a woman is pregnant, whether she's on birth control pills, whether she has something like PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome. Those waves keep coming. So the birth control pills, from my understanding, have nothing to do with interrupting that wave because the wave just keeps coming, and there's not much that we know about that's going to obstruct that.
Dr. Shroga?
I agree. They have not found that being on birth control pills can kind of prevent the loss of those eggs or recruitment of those eggs. And so there doesn't seem to be an effect of people that have used birth control versus those who haven't and what their ovarian reserve is later in life.
Sarah, does that answer your question?
Very much. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Just as an aside, it's not uncommon in our area of medicine to see a young couple where they've been contracepting, they've been using birth control pills, and the girl decides it's time to get pregnant. She stops the pills, and she's having hot flashes. And during the time that she was on the pills, she became, frankly, menopausal. And that's a pretty terrifying event for, you know, because usually they're young in their mid to late 20s, and they're having hot flashes. And
Do the pills cause that, or
no,
it just happened?
It's just that they have periods while they're on the pills.
So they don't think.
Exactly. And so when they stop the pills, they don't have a period, and then they're having hot flashes, and they go to the gynecologist and get a very tough diagnosis.
What about the cases, and I've read about this, where some women now take medication so they don't have periods, or they only have periods once a year or something like that? Does that affect? Is that common? I mean, I read about it in one of those magazines. Is that common?
I mean, I think we're seeing it more and more. There's a lot of women that experience a lot of pain with their periods, and so there's a lot of new regimens out there with birth control pills, other medications, other hormonal medications to prevent periods, to kind of prevent that pain. It doesn't affect the ovarian reserve, but it can help prevent pain and other problems like endometriosis, which can be a different problem that women can have during infertility.
But it won't hurt their ability to have a child
later.
Again, our number is 513-419-7100. Angela's calling from Norwood. Hi, Angela. Angela?
Hi.
Hi. Yes. What's your question?
My question addresses a previous statement. One of the doctors had said that more medicine is required with egg donors in Cincinnati than in other places. And I wondered, do you know if those were egg donors who had grown up in Cincinnati, or were they just simply people who lived here now?
I don't know the answer to your question, but most of our egg donors are pretty much from Cincinnati. But we get egg donors from Lexington and Indianapolis and Cleveland. It's from this general area, but the majority of the egg donors we use are from Cincinnati.
But the troubles are that you've noticed are in that three-state region, everybody?
It's in the pool that we recruit from.
So it's not just the people from Cincinnati. Angela, does that answer your question?
Yeah, just thinking about my little girls and, you know, growing up in a place where maybe that's a problem. So thank you.
Thanks for your call. Again, our number is 513-419-7100. Shane called in, or emailed in rather, and says, a study cited showed GMO products consumed by mice reduced fertility. I don't know what GMO is. Maybe you all do.
I don't know what that is.
Okay. Shane, if you want to write back and tell us what GMO stands for, you've stumped us all here. So we'd be happy to try to answer that question if we know what that is. If you want to email us, you can do that as well. Our email address is talk@wvxu.org. As folks are, as you talked about, you know, what you want to do to, you have ovulation and you want to try for 12 months to work to get pregnant if you're under 35 years old. Are there other things during that time you should be doing? Is this a time to give up alcohol and to, you know, eat the healthiest foods and all those sorts of things? And is it different for the man and the woman? Do they have to do different things to be sure that they're in the best possible condition to conceive?
One thing for the woman that she can do is avoid alcohol in the second half of her menstrual cycle. That's implantation takes place about 3 weeks after her period starts. So just to prevent any alcohol, it's not going to help improve pregnancy, but decrease complications of the pregnancy. Also, obesity or being overweight can cause a decrease in the fertility of the woman. And even in male, it can also affect male sperm. So if you're overweight, need to lose some weight, even losing 5 to 10% of your body weight may improve your ability to get pregnant.
GMO, genetically modified foods. So that was what Shane was asking about. Is that, he says it consumed by mice reduced fertility. Do you know anything about that with
not women? A thing.
Okay. I don't know. Sorry, Shane, we don't have the knowledge on that one. So we had talked about, you were talking about the idea of, avoiding alcohol. And for men, you talked about women. Should men be avoiding alcohol at the same time?
I think so. Tobacco products are just as bad for men as they are for women. And while I don't know that every man needs to wear boxer shorts, I think they need to be cognizant of their exercise. And same with women. Too much exercise can be detrimental for both partners. So
now that seems to go against what you'd expect, because you would expect people who are physically fit and exercising all the time would be in the best position. But you say you can go overboard?
Absolutely. Like I said, anything in excess. So, you know, if women exercise to the point where they are becoming anorectic, or, you know, their body habitus is like an anorectic woman, that's very detrimental to her reproductive health. We had a couple where he had almost no sperm, and we had to do IVF with an intracytoplasmic sperm injection. And then he got injured, and he couldn't ride his bike anymore, and they got pregnant on their own. Because all of a sudden, his sperm count came back up to normal because he was spending so much time on his bike. And he was not just a casual rider. He was a very aggressive rider. And so there was those are simple examples of how just what you consider normal activities can affect things. Now, I think we all agree that a healthy couple is going to have a healthy pregnancy and be a healthy mother and stuff, but when you get to the extremes, it is not good.
Kevin's calling in from Norwood. Hi, Kevin. What's your question?
Yes. So my wife, I'm 34 years old. My wife is 36 years old. We've been married for just over 11 years now. And my wife early on was having issues with her cycle and whatnot. We found out that she had polycystic ovarian disease and also a pretty severe endometriosis, and we got those taken care of via a set of surgeries while we were living in Omaha, Nebraska. And since then, everything was working fine. Her periods were coming normally on time. I got tested at the time, and it's been, 7-8 years now, and we both seem to be in great working order. We're both healthy people. We work out, but not too much, as I just heard, just to stay healthy. And I'm wondering if there's anything in addition. I mean, she's seeing somebody right now, possibly going to be put on Clomid. And we've tried that before several years ago, and it didn't work. And then we moved, and so we got new doctors and whatnot. And so I'm just wondering if there's anything additional that we could be doing, or if perhaps I need to get tested again. I mean, the last time I got tested was about 10 years ago, and so I guess that's my question.
I definitely would recommend retesting. Things can change. You're in a different environment, exposed to different things. So making sure that the sperm is still healthy as it was 10 years ago. Endometriosis, although it was taken care of 10 years ago, it can recur. It's one of those diseases that if a woman's ovulating and making hormones from her ovaries, it can recur, and it could cause problems with the tubes. Also, just the inflammation is thought to decrease fertility. And so having that looked at again might also be something to look into.
I would encourage ovarian reserve testing. In papers that we published many years ago, we looked at what is the kind of the threshold where you start picking up a lot of the women with diminished ovarian reserve. And as she mentioned earlier, that 35 is kind of a break there for us. And while it maybe upsets some gynecologists, we really believe that if you have no children and the woman's 35, you should be seen by a specialist, because we're going to get you pregnant faster so that if you're wanting to extend your family with a second child, you won't be starting that when you're 38 or 39 years old. So I think you as a couple need a pretty sophisticated workup, testing the sperm, making sure the tubes are still open, and some ovarian reserve testing.
Does that help you, Kevin?
It does. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you so much for your call. If you have a question or a comment, you can call us at 513-419-7100. Email talk@wvxu.org. We're on Facebook and Twitter as well. This comes in an email from Hannah, who says, do birth control implants such as, and I'm sure I'm not saying this right, Nexplanon and Implanon, you probably know how to say that better than I do they have an effect?
So Nexplanon and Implanon are they're progestin-only birth control pills that are implanted into the arm. There's been no effect on ovarian reserve. So the only thing with it's really more the one that we know about is Depo-Provera. There is a delay in return to fecundity. So it can be from anywhere from 6 months of not having periods after stopping it up to 9. And people might not be able to have successful pregnancies till after 12 months of using Depo-Provera. So if you're not interested in getting pregnant right now, but maybe next year you want to have a baby, Depo-Provera is definitely one to stay away from. Really, none of the other types of hormonal contraceptive have any of those risks.
This question is from Lisa, and she wants to know what the success rate is. Well, IVF, I know what that is, and IUIs?
Intrauterine inseminations.
Okay.
Well, you can't answer that question without a lot more information, because everything is so couple dependent. There's so many independent variables. We have to report our IVF statistics to the federal government so the consumer can go there to get an idea as to how well each program does. But at the same time, the people that we treat are quite a bit different. So typically the answer to that would be, well, the younger you are, the woman is particularly, the higher the success rate. And intrauterine insemination mandates that there be a pretty normal sperm count, okay? Because if the sperm count is very low, or the motility is how well they swim is very poor, IUIs aren't going to offer you a very good chance of getting pregnant. But if that's all normal, doing inseminations is not a bad thing. But again, the older the woman is, the more aggressive we get. And so then you move on to IVF. So again, it's impossible to give, unless we have specific circumstances, to give outcome numbers. And I'm not trying to be vague or anything like that. It's just, you know, it's every couple is different, and you have to learn about the couple. As I said, when we do start the fertility workup, we're trying to learn about the couple because they're going to be different from everybody else.
We're going to take a call now with someone who has some thoughts about this as well. Kelly's calling in from Cincinnati. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, what's your comment?
I was calling just to make a comment, and I don't know if it fits into the discussion or not, but had actually gone through in vitro and had two children from having in vitro done, but the comment I wanted to make was how important it is for the doctors to take into consideration the person's beliefs and kind of what their expectations are. When we started the whole process, I was 36, and I think the doctor assumed that I was in premenopause, and I talked to him about it was really important for me not to harm any of the embryos, that we wanted everything implanted. And he assured me that we'd have 4 or 5 embryos and that they all could be implanted. Well, when we went for the day of implantation, he said, oh, my gosh, we have 4 and they look really good and we can't implant all 4. I'm like, what do you mean we can't implant all 4? And he basically said he could only do 2 because it would be too dangerous to do that and I needed to freeze the other 2. So I asked him, is it going to harm the embryos? And he said no, but when I went back to have the other 2 implanted later on, he said that, you know, a third die in the falling out phase. And that was something I didn't understand and was very upset about and still have guilt about. So I just wanted to kind of make a comment that doctors deal with this every day, but sometimes it's really important to kind of take a step back and see where the patient's coming from and make sure they understand all of the process. And
Dr. Hoffman, your comments about that?
I would say that... And I'm sure Dr. Schwarz's consent for embryo cryopreservation is probably not a whole lot different than ours. But in there are various scenarios about what happens to the embryos. And that's usually when the couple reads that, that's usually when they hold their hand up and say, we have problems with this. You know, our religious beliefs are strong in this area. And I say, okay, let me tell you how the process works. And as we go through that process, when we come to that red line for you, that's when you put your hand up and say, this is where I will not accept this. And I says, we will do our best to abide directly to that. And it's my years of 25 that I found out those people who have such strong beliefs do a little bit better because maybe somebody's looking over their shoulder. But we can tailor everything we do to the couple's beliefs. Sometimes it may not be in their best cost-benefit benefit area, but at the same time, we are very positively wanting to make sure that we don't cross that red line for them. And usually it's when they get into the frozen embryo consent, when they read and learn about all of that, that's when they realize there may be problems. And when my patients have those problems, they just, I say, well, let me tell you what we do, and you tell me what we can't do.
That sounds great. That sounds great. I wish my doctor would have done that.
I hear your little people in the background.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kelly. We appreciate it. Again, our phone number, if you have a question or a comment, is 513-419-7100. We're talking today about infertility and treatments available to help couples who are having trouble getting pregnant. You can email us as well as call us. Email talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. We're talking infertility and how treatments have changed during the past several decades. My guests are Bethesda Fertility Center Medical Director Dr. Glenn Hoffman and Dr. Julie Siroga with the University of Cincinnati Center for Reproductive Health. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100. Email us, talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We go now to Sarah from Northside. Hi, Sarah. What's your question?
Hi. I am 39, and I recently married, and my husband and I are just starting to try to have children. Well, we got pregnant, and then I lost the pregnancy at about 7 weeks. But this is the first time we've tried, and I'm obviously older at 39. So I didn't know if you had any advice for older women trying to have their first pregnancy, because it was a little bit scary to, you know, we got pregnant, that was exciting, and then we lost it, and then the doctors told us that can be kind of normal, but trying.
Sarah,
again,
the exact same thing happened to me, so if that makes you feel any better. 39, lost the first one. I have an 11-year-old now, though, by the way. I'm sorry, Dr. Hoffman. I don't want to sound too encouraging, but that did work for me.
Well, it the fact that you got pregnant and had an intrauterine pregnancy tells us a lot about the physiology. That you ovulated, that the egg got out of the ovary, the fallopian tube picked up the egg, started moving it towards the uterus, the sperm got up there and fertilized the egg, and then the fallopian tube put it down in the uterus and implanted. But that's not the end point of the game. The game is to have a child. So while that is, it tells us about the biology, it doesn't get us any closer to the solution. And I would just suggest that at age 39, you have a fairly rapid and a focused investigation on your chances of getting pregnant, because we're mentioning 35 is kind of the break point where couples should be seeking more focused care. At 39, your chances of having a child together is much less than if you were 35, and it just doesn't get any better each month that you're trying.
I agree. I mean, you were able to get pregnant, and so we do know certain things, but possibly intervention with treatment may help you get pregnant faster, which, again, it doesn't guarantee the result of having a delivery, but you don't want to waste too much time in between your pregnancies because it can just become harder and harder to get pregnant.
When it was me, I had two miscarriages before I had my daughter, and they told me to wait 3 months before trying again. Is that what you still say or not?
I don't.
No, just try right away again?
I usually just make sure the pregnancy hormone's negative and then start trying again.
Sarah,
okay,
are you being?
They did tell me.
I'm sorry.
They did tell me to wait. They did tell me to wait a couple months. So that was going to be another question I was going to ask if they would recommend that. But they say go for it. So, okay.
Good luck. I hope you can call
Thank
back and tell
much.
Us about a healthy baby. Thank you so much for calling, Sarah. Again, our phone number 513-419-7100. Sally is calling from Lebanon. Hi, Sally.
Hi, Sally. Thanks for having me. I was calling because my husband and I are trying to get pregnant. He's been tested, and his count and motility is good. I've been utilizing the ovulation trackers, and my cycle is a little bit longer. I ovulate, or that strip indicates positive at day 20. So what effects would that have on us trying to get pregnant, since there is that later ovulation?
I mean, the ovulation test is showing that you are ovulating, and so it's important to have intercourse around that time of your ovulation and not based on that 14-day, you know, day 14 that a lot of people will read in, because that's based on a 28-day cycle. Your cycle's longer, but it's still showing, based on your ovulation predictor kit, that you're ovulating. One thing you can do, you can do blood work to confirm that ovulation a week after that predictor kit, getting a progesterone level, just to confirm that you really are ovulating and it's not a inaccurate test, because although the ovulation predictor kits are great, they're not 100% accurate. So a positive change doesn't mean that you definitely ovulated, and a negative ovulation predictor kit also doesn't mean you didn't miss it.
Okay, that brings another question. I've had a progesterone test, which I think is what you're referring to with the blood work. What day of your cycle or what should I be getting that progesterone, given the fact that I ovulate later than kind of the average?
Ideally about 7 days after your predicted ovulation. So if your kit's saying day 20, then you'd want to get it on day 27.
Okay.
Thanks for calling, Sally.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. Our phone number, 513-419-7100. A woman called in who did not want to give her name, but said she had in vitro at 45 with donated sperm and had a healthy baby at 46. So she wanted to let folks know there is hope. Do you think that that's common at that age, that that works?
I think
well?
It's the exception rather than the rule, but it's very uncommon if it were really her own eggs.
And then RC in Cincinnati says, what options are there for someone who cannot afford in vitro?
It depends on if they really need in vitro. So I guess, you know, there could be different options where they've already gone through infertility treatment and haven't been successful, and then they're at in vitro. And then also people that require it because their tubes are blocked or the sperm's significantly abnormal.
They apparently had tried in vitro once and it did not work.
That's unfortunate. And it's very unfortunate because a lot of fertility care is not covered by insurance. The insurance is mandated to pay all the diagnostic things, but then we get to say, okay, well, now we know what's wrong, and this is what it's going to take to fix it, and that's where they have problems. And there's no question that finances and the cost, and not so much only the dollars, but the emotional expense can get prohibitive. And it's really unfortunate when you work a couple up and you say, now I know what's wrong, but this is what you need to fix it. You need in vitro fertilization, and they say, well, we can't afford that. And
what does it cost, approximately?
Depending on how much drugs a woman has and whether they need intracytoplasmic sperm injection, anywhere from $8,000 to $10,000.
With every try.
With every try.
Now, there are some centers at our center at UC. We have an insurance program that we work with, so a couple can kind of buy extra cycles up front, and like for a certain rate, and they get, you know, a certain number of cycles, and if they don't get pregnant, they get some money back. I mean, the risk is they get pregnant the first time, then they've kind of overpaid for the IVF cycle. But there are a lot of different programs out there like that. We also do have a gift of life program for couples that are without a child, that are married. There are certain criteria they have to meet, but it is a discounted IVF cycle. So I do encourage anyone that is interested to look at our website and see if they would qualify.
When do you get to a point where you just tell people that you're sorry and you just don't think there's anything more that can be done?
It happens all the time. It's very sad, because what I will typically do when I do my workup for ovarian reserve, and the woman's AMH is not detectable and her FSH is 45, I sit down and I put things into a cost-benefit ratio perspective, intercourse, Clomid with inseminations, injectable medications with inseminations, IVF, donor egg, embryo donation and adoption. And for most of those, the live birth rates are less than 1%, less than 1%, less than 1%, until we get down to the donor egg, or the embryo donation. But those dollars get really big with the egg donation. So it's not uncommon at all. That's, to me, the purpose of the ovarian reserve screening is to be able to counsel the patient as to what their options are and what their likelihood of outcome is going to be. And then if they want to move forward, it allows us to tailor the type of stimulation or treatment they need to their individual situations.
But at some point, you do have to say you've done everything you can. Do you ever find that those people come back and have a baby after that?
Yes, and it's a blessing,
What about, you often hear about people once they actually stop trying. You know, one of the frustrating things, I think some people, you know, their friends will tell them, just relax. You're too nervous about it. I mean, is that really an issue, that whole just relax thing?
I mean, there is something in that stress can affect the hormones that go between the brain and the ovary. And we do see that women, once they relax a little bit or they stop trying, they don't think about it, they'll say, oh, I got pregnant. You hear that story a lot. And that might be just that they've tried enough, you know, because the chance is not zero. They just got to that point where it was successful. So does it mean that if you just reduce stress, you'll improve outcomes? They've looked at things like acupuncture, and there really isn't a definite improvement with acupuncture, and women definitely feel less relaxed. There's some improvement in some studies. Other studies show no difference. So that's one of the things that stress can play a role in these things, but I don't know if we can chalk it all up to that.
One of the items I wanted to get to before we run out of time is the whole idea of so many people now have been treated for cancer and more are surviving. They're being treated. They're in remission. But it does cause problems with fertility. And I know, Dr. Sroga, you're working with this in the field, oncofertility. Am I saying that correctly?
Correct.
Tell us what kind of work you're doing and what you advise for folks who are being treated for cancer if they want to be able to go on to have children if they survive.
I think the biggest thing is just meeting with someone, either your oncologist or a reproductive endocrinologist, to really understand your risk. There are a lot of data out there now that certain chemotherapies put a woman or man at really high risk of sterility after treatment. And so we can do something before they get that medication. A lot of times after they receive that medication or radiation, there's not a lot to do. They're already left with a reduced number of eggs or essentially without periods or sterile, and men can be left without sperm. So we really encourage kind of that reproductive counseling visit up front to see, you know, are you at significant risk? What are the different options? And there's a lot of different options that are out there. A couple of them have become come out of the experimental phase, and now we call them standard treatment. So egg freezing used to be experimental. That's now an option for girls or women that are post-puberty. They can do embryo freezing. For younger girls that aren't able to do those things because they're not in puberty or if there's not a lot of time, there is some experimental data about ovarian tissue freezing, where we actually freeze pieces of the ovary and we can reimplant them later on. And, you know, there's oncofertility consortium across the country that's working with those tissues to try to be able to have more things to offer girls if they have the frozen tissue someday.
Dr. Hoffman?
We have a very active fertility preservation program, and we've been very successful in freezing and thawing eggs and making babies. And our greatest frustration is we never see these patients until after the treatment. And breast cancer is an excellent example because by the time when they make the diagnosis, it can be quite a while before they actually start treatment with radiation and chemotherapy. So that gives us as fertility people a tremendous window of opportunity to intervene and get the eggs and freeze them. I've met with oncologists multiple times trying to, this is, just let them know this is an option. You know, here's our brochure. We can do this. And with the treatment protocols we have now, for example, women with hormone receptor positive breast cancers, we do not want their estrogen levels to get very high while we're stimulating them to retrieve the eggs. And typically with IVF, it'll get to be 5 or 10 times higher or maybe 20 times higher than in a natural cycle. But there's ways we can do that so that while we stimulate their ovaries to get the eggs, their estrogen levels never get above what there is in a natural cycle. So we don't offer any risk to enhancing the cancer if it's an estrogen-dependent tumor. Yeah, we have what we call standard operating procedure protocols that if a woman is being seen by an oncologist and she wants to talk about fertility preservation, we'll get her in within 48 hours. And, you know, we have counseling as to how she can afford the medications because there's organizations.
So I was going to say, does insurance cover any of that?
It's getting better. It's getting better. But the problem is awareness. Is couples just aren't aware that they have this right to at least a consultation. And our frustration, again, is the oncologists are trained to cure the disease. And it's rare that, you know, I see a young man with testicular cancer and for them to collect samples or if they've got a lymphoma or something like that, it's exceptional when they actually go and click. Because for men, it's very simple. You take a couple days and you're done. You can have sperm for, you know, 3 years worth of treatment. For women, it's not that simple. But like she said, freezing eggs is not experimental anymore. She mentioned how we used to slow freeze them, and that was terrible. Now we vitrify them, and it's a whole lot simpler. But that technology is available today. But getting the message out to the patients before it's too late, because she says it's so often that they get their treatment.
And then it is
too late. And then they're very angry because they didn't have the opportunity to at least explore whether they would want to take advantage of that option.
I'm definitely seeing, though, an improvement. I don't know if it's related to the fact that we lifted that ban of freezing eggs being experimental or not. But I've visited a lot of oncologists in the UC area, UC as well as just in the area, just to let them know what's out there, what we can do. And also at UC, we get them in within 48 hours. And we're also working on just spreading the knowledge. I think that's the most important thing that people can take from this.
It's awareness. And if I forgot to say awareness.
We have a call now from Patrick in Western Hills. Hi, Patrick. What's your question?
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, I had a quick question. I've been introduced to the Creighton model, and I was wondering if you guys have any kind of details about that, and if you are currently using that practice to kind of do family planning. It generally came through the Catholic Church. Do you have any information on that?
Do you guys know anything about the Creighton model?
I do, and I think it has significant appropriateness for couples who have very strong religious beliefs, because sometimes people will find what happens in fertility treatments to cross the ethical borders for them, just like the woman said about freezing her embryos and loss of the embryo. So I think for selected couples who have very strong religious beliefs, and the person who's designed this is here in Ohio, it is helpful to them. But then when that doesn't work, it kind of leaves us in a very tough spot because, again, and I'm sure he knows that once we get past that and it's not working, then we have to go back to standard fertility treatments. And for a lot of people, that is, you know, that's, like I said, is a big red line for them.
Patrick, thank you so much for your call. We appreciate it. We're just about wrapping up here. So I want to remind everybody that we have information on our website, WVXU.org. Go to the Cincinnati Edition page, and there are links to both of our doctors' information and their organizations and how you can get in touch with them and find information out there. I know you both refer to some website information there. One of the things we didn't talk a lot about is you talk about Clomid and various treatments. Is all of this safe for the baby to come?
I think so, because Clomid's been on the market since 1966. And we look at risk as the number of women use years, how many women have used this drug over what period of time. And particularly for Clomid, it's been for decades. So if there were an increased risk of ovarian cancer or breast cancer, or any kind of estrogen-dependent cancer, it would be everywhere because, you know, you can go out and find, without any work, find 10 women who've been on Clomid in the past. The injectable medications, it's a little bit different because we really didn't start using them until the late 80s, but they've been following it very carefully. So now we have decades as well. For IVF, there is concerns about the babies, but not for the use of Clomid.
Thank you both for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
That was a great question.
Very enlightening hour. We've been talking today about infertility. My guests, Bethesda Fertility Center Medical Director Dr. Glenn Hoffman and Dr. Julie Siroga with the University of Cincinnati Center for Reproductive Health. Cincinnati Edition is produced by Pete Reitmeier. Today's technical director was Bruce Ellis. Our engineering staff is Don Danko, Bill Dean, and Mike Makinich. We also had help today from Jim Nolan. I'm Marianne Zalesnik.